Welcome back to Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated. Two-man crew rolling today. We won't make any Miami comments after that. But Tim Priester, Notre Dame picked up much-anticipated Braden Parks, makes it official. And according to a lot of people, Darian Prescott, 2028 edge recruit, of course, is pending a potential announcement for Notre Dame today on Monday. We will obviously talk about that after it happens as well. But we've talked a lot about Parks. We can circle back to him, Tim, but I wanted to get your thoughts on Darian Prescott from Bolingbrook.
Yeah, he's 24/7 has him rated the number four player in the class of 2028. And you see why. I mean, he's got all the physical gifts that you could ask for. He has length. I see the actual length that he's been measured at or listed at has changed a little bit shorter than the 6'6" that they've said, but he has put weight on since last season. I think he's a really, really physically, athletically, he's a really, really dynamic prospect. I think there are some things in his game that, you know, we were talking about before we started recording. You start to get a little spoiled with Jackson Vaughn, you know, Sagoon Alexander, that you look at these guys and like, well, hell, they're ready to come in and contribute now, or they can easily come in as a senior in high school and be ready for this level of football. I wouldn't put Prescott quite in that category.
Nor do we.
It's like, I don't know how much of a trend this is going to be. Nationally, it's going to be a trend. I don't know how much of a trend it will be for Notre Dame, but I look at him and say, okay, he needs two more years of high school as opposed to one, just because, you know, he needs to be more, I think, more violent with his hands. I don't think that he really, and I mean, it's just evolution of a young football player, how to use it, how to use them as weapons. I think there are times where I wrote it in a film review that, you know, he goes along for the ride with an offensive lineman with an offensive lineman sometimes a little bit and doesn't shed the block, but you know, he has all the intangibles, all the ingredients you want in a defensive end. I compared him to Eric Gentry and Charles Snowden, Gentry from USC and Snowden from Virginia, that played against Notre Dame. But then I saw that Notre Dame director of scouting, Andrew Ivan, said he could get up to 280. Well, then he's Jerry Tillery if he's going to be 280.
24/7 director of scouting. Yeah.
Thank you.
A big move if it was Notre Dame director of scouting.
Yeah. Did I say that?
Yeah. Thank but you. You're right, though. You mentioned Jerry. If he's 280, he's Jerry Tillery. He's going to be, then he can enroll early, but not early, a year and a half. We want to qualify. Priester and I are talking about him if he were to be a reclassification player. Obviously, when he is a true incoming freshman, he will make these strides. You're saying, like, right, hey, let's try to pull back a little bit. Not everybody can be coming in a year and a half early. He could come in a half a year early. That's certainly the new wave, is guys enroll early.
Right.
But that's four seasons of high school football.
Yeah, we have to have a different classification for the early entry, I guess.
So that's nuts, too. I know it's going to keep on going, but most edge rushers probably should have four seasons of high school football under their belt before they come to Notre Dame. Yeah. Can you imagine being an edge rusher coming in a full year early to Notre Dame, and then you have two-year starter Will Black waiting for you there, and you're getting your first rep, and it's just a 0% chance of what? There's no way.
Imagine if you came in when Joe Alt was stationed at left tackle and you're dealing with that.
You could have been 21 and come in. It wouldn't have done so well for you.
It wouldn't have mattered. No, it wouldn't have mattered.
Very quickly, Tim, we'll go back. You spoke and wrote about Braden Parks plenty, but he has made it official. And it's just really, it's, for me, as good as Parks is, it is the absolute ridiculous depth of the defensive line class of the last 2 years and the offensive line class of the last years. I know that's been written elsewhere as well, but it is... it's remarkable, because if you're an offensive and defensive line driven program, this is what you actually need. And Priester, you and I joked, maybe Freeman should stop saying that last year because it doesn't help with wide receiver recruiting. Doesn't really matter. If you're going to get these guys, you can keep saying that all you want.
Well, I think we all, you know, you reach a point, you got the first five defensive linemen and you wait several weeks on Braden Parks. You get a little greedy. Because I would rate him higher than number 160. I said that, wrote that when I did the film review on him months ago. So, you know, I'm looking at it, it's like, okay, it'd be fine if you have these five, but man, if you could just get Parks, he's a nose tackle that has defensive tackle mobility and pass rush mobility, really, really completes a six, which is why I'm saying that Prescott needs to wait another year. He doesn't need to come in with that class Am I getting the years mixed up? No, I think I got that. He doesn't need to, he doesn't need to come in with that class. But yeah, Braden Parks, I think, is a real, real unique talent. Great burst for a guy that's coming from the middle of the defensive line. What can you say? Six in my mind. And look, they're not all going to hit.
Well, that's why it's so important.
Right. That's exactly right. And they're not all going to hit. But as you watch high school film of them, I don't have any reason to say, you know, anything other than this guy looks like a player and he should help Notre Dame quite a bit.
Yeah, they never all hit, but that's why this depth is remarkable. And that's why three commitments ago when I was talking about, oh, well, they did this once in 2011 with three top 40 defensive linemen, but one didn't hit. Well, they didn't do it with six of them. I mean, the drop off from where they were, I was talking about Tuitt, Lynch, and
Eastman. Right. And you know, I know you know who else was in that class, Tony Springman.
Springman, too, but that's a big drop off from these guys.
Anthony Rabassa.
Yeah.
Who didn't make it. Brad Carrico, who ended up getting shifted to the defensive line. So when you start comparing Notre Dame six-man class,
it's ridiculous.
I keep misspeaking, don't I, Tim? Just correct me when I misspeak, please. I appreciate
it. Carrico probably wasn't that important to correct you over. I probably should have let that one go. But there, no, don't need to. I want to correct Steve Sarkisian because Notre Dame and Texas matchups are fun, and he might be balking at that. But I want to point out for all our listeners, we brought this up in a May podcast when Texas AD Chris Conte mentioned the Notre Dame-Texas signed agreement was perhaps not going to play out. He wasn't sure. It was in limbo. So this has been, I think Sarkisian is the new mouthpiece for the Conte saying we may not be able to keep that series intact. It's not a surprise. Once the AD comes out and says a series that they have signed, a home and home, is uncertain. It's a lot more than uncertain.
Then it's a lot more than uncertain. And I remember being in the interview with Pete Bavakwa talking about, you know, he was talking about getting it set up with a game set up with Texas and the relationship he had with Chris Conte. And he was really excited about that. And, you know, I mean, Notre Dame, Texas goes back to, my early childhood of going to the Cotton Bowl when I was 10 years old, Notre Dame ending Texas's 30 game winning streak. But yeah, you're absolutely right. When an AD says it's in question, then it's most likely over.
I think we used the term non-committal back then, but that makes it most likely over. And I believe there's a much larger penalty if he were to officially cancel the home and home before this season starts, or 1 year before that game was supposed to be played. It's $500,000. If he waits longer, it's a much stiffer penalty. So it's good news, I suppose, if you get to September 20th and it hasn't been canceled yet, because certainly they're looking at the financial ramifications of canceling something like that. Opposite of not fun is Shields Family Hall. Tim Priester seems pretty fun. You're able to. It looks fantastic. Sometimes Notre Dame internal media does a great job, videos led by Katie Lonergan, but I think it's really fun to watch these players' reactions to seeing Shields Family Hall in a reveal. It's fun to have guys that are this high up in the Notre Dame football food chain being excited little kids when they see their new place to go hang out.
It's difficult to believe that that is Notre Dame.
I
think, you know, it's good theater to get their reactions and stuff, but that's genuine, man.
No, that's what I mean.
When we get a tour of it, which will come along here in the next few weeks, I'm sure my reaction and your reaction is going to be very similar. It's hard to imagine they don't have lockers for us. We don't get to sit in them like the guys were doing the other day, but yeah, it's really hard to believe that Notre Dame has state of the art. And that means that somebody will build another one next year that will be more state of the art than Notre Dame's. Yeah. You know, the wear and tear begins on the Shields, but it's just opening now, and it's great for the players. It's so functional. That's the main thing. Is we see all the bells and whistles and the lights and stuff, but the functionality of the facility is the main thing, and nobody's going to be complaining about Notre Dame's facilities here in the short term.
No, what's funny is, and well, before we get to a break here, I remember it must have been 2010 or 11, could have even been as late as 12. There was a national, it was Stuart Mandel, actually. So it was probably 12 if he was on campus. We were waiting outside Loftus, inside the Goog. And Tim, do you remember that sign that from 1993? It was just a white sign on the ground that said only Notre Dame students allowed inside on the Loftus Field turf. They still had a sign in that, from 1993, like almost like a to give a visual, it's like a wet floor sign is how big it was in front of the door at Loftus, and it's like 2012. And Mandel looks at me and he's like, "Is this it?" I go, "No, that's always been there." Just to think of what they have now, as opposed to a little handwritten sign, only student athlete or students, because they allowed students on the Loftus floor as well. We used to play tackle football or touch football on there as well on that field. They're not going to let you go play inside at the IAC.
No, they won't.
If you're a senior, it doesn't work out that way. All right, I'm going to use shock jock here for you, Tim Priester. Notre Dame is the best team in the history of Tim Priester's first rate history. I think I know why. It's because they're compared against their opponents, and they've usually had some tougher opponents along the way. But they are. Notre Dame has tied Clemson 2020 as the best, lowest point total, which is the best team in the 11-year history now of first rate. And go ahead and explain yourself, Tim Priester.
Well, I still have coaching to throw on there, but that's not going to change.
It's not going to change the
rankings. No, Notre Dame's not going to lose any ground in that category. It's, you know, I mean, like, there's no preconceived. You try not to have any preconceived notions going into this, and I never have. That was the whole idea of doing this series 16 years ago. That let's just look at this honestly and place Notre Dame players where you think they should be in positions. And it's a combination of two things. Notre Dame has more talent than they've had in their football program collectively, depth-wise, since 1993. And depth-wise, it may be even a little bit greater than that. Maybe not, you know, first round draft choices, which they were spitting out on a regular basis in the early 90s. But I mean, the depth of talent looks really, really good. And then you've got a schedule where the first six opponents were bad last year. You know, they each lost at least eight games. And then, you know, it comes down to three games, or it should come down to three games. If it comes down to anything other than those three and they don't succeed, now, even if they don't succeed, I guess, against those three opponents, the expectation is 12-0. And that's why in my Thursday thoughts last week, it's like, I know how this is all going to unfold. If they're not beating teams by four touchdowns, then somebody's screwing up, or that will be the impression from the outside looking in. And we've just got to remember that nobody hammers each one of their opponents every week, and there'll be some slip-ups along the way. But should Notre Dame be 12-0, Tim?
Yeah, they should
be. I think they should be. Yeah. Yes, I think they should
be. And the context to it, I was kind of joking about the, like, Ohio State was a great – Ohio State 22 and 2023 were your number one ranked teams in 2022 and 2023. But there was more there. There was Clemson. Like, it was Ohio State, Clemson, and Notre Dame those years, and you still also had USC to throw in there. So you're ranking it against who they're playing. It matters a lot if you had Ohio State and Miami – on this schedule. First of all, wow, that'd be pretty exciting. But secondly, Notre Dame would not be the number one ranked team in the history of it. They wouldn't be the number one ranked team in every category, or almost every category, because you're throwing another powerhouse in there. It's just the absence of another powerhouse is really what does this. And if you go back in time, Notre Dame wasn't as good either. So, like,
right. And the powerhouses this year are, you know, BYU compared to Clemson.
Compared to Clemson.
SMU compared to Clemson a couple years ago.
And no USC changes things. Right. There's positions USC has where they all of a sudden that moves.
Well, I remember when I started this version of the series months ago, and I kept looking for USC. You know, I don't have to look up USC for purpose of what I'm doing. And now I've kind of forgotten about them. But yeah, that would be, I mean, USC is expected to, at least, well, just ask them. They really expect to be great.
They have a hard schedule, Tim.
They have a very difficult schedule. They have a very difficult schedule. So I expect them to slip up, you know, just because of their history. Like, why would all of this change right now from what they have been doing?
Yeah, right. No, I totally agree with you.
Maybe a change at coordinator will help them, but
I think Notre Dame fans don't realize Gary Patterson, the former TCU head coach,
he's in DC, and he did great. He did great, great things at TCU defensively. Now, you know, I know people, he's been out of the game. He didn't forget what he knows, and I'm sure the evolution of the game hasn't gone past him. But Notre Dame doesn't play them, except maybe in playoffs.
Or I guess not. They don't play them then. So, Tim, this is right up your alley because we finished this. Other than coaching, related question from VA Doc. Notre Dame fans are anticipating perhaps the best one-on-one battle of the 2026 regular season. if Malachi Toney indeed gets covered by Leonard Moore. Are there other great one-on-one or position group matchups we should anticipate during the 2026 regular season? I have a couple. I'll let you drop them in first since you finished.
No, I've got more than a couple, and I don't want to ramble on any more than I already have. Why don't you go ahead and start, Tim?
So I'm going to start outside the box, and I'm going Rhett Lashley in charge of his offense versus Chris Ash at the end of the year. Lashley with a playoff spot on the line, and Chris Ash with a number top four seed on the line in that game. That is my other team's offense versus Notre Dame's defense. I mean, there's like 10 Miami ones, so I'm kind of leaving out some of the Miami stuff, but that's my under the radar offense versus defense.
Yeah. I'm very interested. I'll try to keep this brief. I'm very interested. And we do have a question about one of Notre Dame's receivers coming up here. Notre Dame's wide receivers against Miami cornerback Xavier Lucas and CJ Frederick. Good defensive backs. Not, they don't have a history of taking the football away. CJ Carr will protect the football probably even a little bit better this year than he did early last year. So that's an interesting matchup. Miami's interior defensive line against Notre Dame's interior offensive line. You know, you still have Scott and Moten there. Those are good football players. I thought that they were even a little bit underrated from the outside looking in last year. Certainly preseason, shouldn't have been during the season. Here's an interesting one. Notre Dame's D line against SMU's offensive line, who has center Joshua Bates, guard Addison Nichols, and tackle PJ Williams. Good offensive linemen. We'll see how Notre Dame does against them. And then the last one I wanted to mention was, BYU center. BYU center's yes. Bruce sure. Mitchell is the best center on the schedule, maybe in the country.
With a running back behind him.
And the running back behind him is very good. So, yeah, Teon Gray, Francis Brew, and that crew on the interior will have a test against Bruce Mitchell from BYU.
My final one was, and I'm going back to your Belichick in his second year with that North Carolina defense, seeing Anthony Knapp, and probably that's week four, so Ashton Craig as well. It's Melkart, right? Melkart Abu Jude, the defensive lineman from North Carolina. That's probably the best defensive lineman on the schedule until the schedule gets tougher, if that's how we want to address the schedule.
Best pass rush guy, Abu Jude. Yeah.
That should be a fun one as well. There's some good ones. And then I think we have to say it. The other side of wide receiver against Notre Dame, if you don't have Leonard Moore on the outside, Cooper Barkhead's going to be a problem against
the I did write down what I wrote down was, who's going to defend Cooper Barkhead?
They have to be Christian Gray if you have Leonard Moore following.
It would have to be Christian Gray if you're going to have Moore try to mirror what Malachi Toney does.
We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. We are back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question from Bob's RVs. You all ranked Mylon Graham number 9 in the countdown. This feels too high, considering you watched a couple of spring practices to come to this conclusion. Actually, I did rank him a little lower than 9, but I like the question, Priester.
Where do you have him?
I am down at 15, which might
be too much. Yeah, that's fair. But and it's a good question. It's a fair question. But my response to that is, well, today is number 6, which is Jordan Faison. So we're saying that Mylon Graham will be the number 2 receiver with CJ Carr as the quarterback.
Right.
Do you think Greathouse will be ahead of him? I don't think so. Micah Gilbert, I don't think so. And I think, you know, we expect CJ Carr to throw for 3,500 yards.
Yep. Yeah. Oh yeah.
I mean, something like that. So somebody's got to be catching those passes and, yeah, we saw a little bit more than you're saying. We actually saw 2 full scrimmages. But the quick twitch nature of Mylon Graham, from the very first rep that he took on the first day of spring practice, we all saw it. There's a quick twitch nature to his game that none of the other receivers have, at least the combination with his size and that burst off the snap of the football.
The thing impressed me most, and I don't know if this is Denbrock or Graham, when there were two, I'm going to say, I guess they were offsides. And of course you play out the play where a defensive end is offsides.
Yeah.
Generally a quarterback's chucking it deep because you have a free play. CJ Carr both times hit Mylon Graham on like a 20 in route. I'm like, gosh, they already have that going together, because that's confidence in your player. That's game awareness. That's not just, I'll take a shot and throw the ball down the field with Leonard Moore guarding somebody so it can be incomplete.
Well, it's already understanding the skill set of your new receiver player from Ohio State.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was March. First of all, the first one was in March. The second was in April. I really like Myron Graham. I went defense heavy. That's why I was 15.
Okay. I don't think 15's unfair.
No, I had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I had 8 defenders. That's 7 defenders, okay. 2 yeah. linemen, and then the obvious.
Well, and that should be, you know, the overall greatest strength of Notre Dame is their defensive side of the ball. That's fair. I looked at it from, I think Faison's going to have a big year. Who's going to be number two? And I don't think it will be a tight end, even if Ian Premer, you know, is what we think he can be as a true freshman.
We, the whole staff, had Graham as the second receiver, to your point. Everybody had Faison Graham too. Like that.
Yeah,
was.
It's just a, yeah. We have a question from Maltese Irish. Christian Gray's grabbiness is oft discussed on the podcast and message board. On Thursday's podcast, Drew Mentock floated the idea of it perhaps being something Aaron Henry can coach out of him. Is this a realistic possibility? And if so, why do you think a great coach like Mike Mickens was unable to do so?
It's a good question. I know that they coach quite a bit of grabbiness, to use the term again. You see a lot in practice, grabbiness on the receivers. I think that's part of how they challenge the wide receivers. I just assume it was part of Gray's matchups is when he got grabby. I'm actually going to ask Christian Gray. I'm not going to use the term grabbiness, even though I think it might have been my term. I'm going to ask him about how do you eliminate some of the penalties, some of the clutching and grabbing penalties, because he had more penalties than everybody by a wide margin. So he had 15 in the last 2 years. That's a lot. That's a fair question. He's also played some of the best receivers, and that's why he has to grab them. But, you know, you'll be getting some really good ones this year, too, as the season progresses. Maybe Mickens coaches him to be a little more aggressive due to his skill set.
Well, you think back to Notre Dame beating Michigan State, Pat Narduzzi, his defensive approach. When in doubt, grab and commit an interference. And I understand the overriding philosophy with that. It's better to give up 15 than 55.
Yeah, yeah. It's a weird rule in modern college football that's the rule. Yeah. But at least it doesn't make it so those terrible – I mean, you imagine with some of these ACC refs that they're giving 55-yard penalties out.
A bad cut. Yeah.
So I don't mind that. It's worth asking Aaron Henry and Christian Gray that, because Aaron Henry, I'm sure, came in. The first thing he saw on tape was Christian Gray. He had enough penalties where you saw them on tape. It's not like something that Aaron Henry's not fully aware of.
Yeah.
Our next question, Irish Utah N. It seems an emerging consensus is that Teddy Girard will be Notre Dame's backup QB by the end of the season. Given that he has no collegiate game film or body of work, what are you seeing, or more likely, what are you hearing behind the scenes that leads you to that conclusion? Is the confidence primarily a reflection of Girard's talent and ceiling, or does it also reflect a lack of confidence in the rest of the QB room?
Another good question. I don't know that it's a lack of confidence in Grubbs, because most of us came away from the spring saying, damn, that kid looks pretty good, more better than we anticipated that he would. Certainly arm strength, his level of competitiveness. I think we were able to observe that during the spring. So it's not a lack of confidence per se. Like, my lack of confidence would be in Blake Hebert. I don't think that Notre Dame looks at him as the quarterback of the future. So that's why you look to the younger guys. I think I look at Teddy Girard as now. Don't hold me to the exact comparison, because I'm not making the exact comparison, but I'm going to say the name CJ Carr from the standpoint that I think
to pull out like Johnny Unitas or something.
No, right? I think that he's got the it factor that we saw with CJ Carr. And like, I didn't say that he would be the number two quarterback at some point late in the season. But it could happen if he's as good out of the gate as we thought he would be. But I think Noah Grubbs is going to give him, you know, a real run. And the guy that is number two out of the gate has to be the one that understands the system the best. Right. And maybe that's Hebert.
Yeah, I think just talking to Gadooly, Hebert was there last year, but he was 100% scout team in his early enrollment because they had 3 QBs. And I'm pretty sure he was 100% scout team around August 7th. I mean, like, it was Mitchie versus Carr all the way to the 17th of August. You weren't getting Blake Hebert reps. There was just no reason to.
No.
He throws a pretty good ball, Hebert. I don't want to denigrate him in the ability to throw a football. We heard from Notre Dame that he wasn't a guy that, first of all, they got Teddy Girard to reclassify it for a couple reasons. They wanted to get him and get him away from Georgia, but not because they love Blake Hebert. They wanted to get Teddy Girard in here to compete.
We saw some inaccuracy issues, though, with Hebert.
But I mean, the ball's good. He can throw a good football.
He throws a good,
accuracy is more important than the spiral, of course. But I'm just saying it's not like he can't throw a football well. Grubbs threw it great when we watched. Obviously, there were times when he didn't. We know that from talking to Dembrock and Gadooly. We saw his first practice, and then they even said, yeah, you saw the first practice. Did you see the second? No. Well, his head was kind of swimming out there. That's what happens. And it's going to happen to Girard. But I want to point one thing out. It says, given that he has no collegiate game film or body of work, neither do Grubbs or Hebert. They have no body of work. No one does. That's why we are going with the guy we think looks best on film coming into the program, because none of them have a body of work.
Yeah, and whether this is an accurate assumption or not, there's an assumption of a level of, and again, I'm not saying the other guys don't have it, but there's an assumption of a level of just confidence in his ability that Teddy Girard walked into Notre Dame with. Now, maybe that's changed in the time that he's been at Notre Dame since June, I guess. But I don't know. We'll see. Like, you know, at this stage, I mean, we've walked all around this topic over and over. It is time for us to watch a football practice and make another irrational judgment about the young quarterbacks.
He is high on the list of irrational judgments coming in the early August segment of when you guys are on the internet watching practice snippets of non-professional quarterback evaluators telling you what's going on. We were right about 2022, though. We nailed that one forever, Tim Priester. Everybody said they look good. You and I were like, well, these guys don't look that good, do they? It was like the major league. We wanted to
major league. I mean, you can't overreact to a pre-practice throwing drill on air with no coverage and going at 40% speed. There was a lot of that judgment going on at that time, and we didn't fall for it. No. Question number four from Any Davis 2. I think we would all agree that Notre Dame is now firmly entrenched as one of the elite programs. Was there a turning point for you? For me, it was 2024 Louisville. That game felt like a true tipping point for the program, and they've been on a tear ever since.
It's a great undervalued tipping point. I like, because that was the game that they could have lost realistically, but should not lose. In a home rematch in the 2024 regular season. Remember, they were without Benjamin Morrison, which was a giant deal. Going against Tyler Shook. Now, the guy that replaced him ran down Tyler Shook and forced a fumble. He was pretty good, too. Leonard Moore. But mine is the Georgia game. That's the first one where you're like, wow, I can't believe they have now. You and I picked Georgia. You still have the feeling of, wow, they've done it. Notre Dame has actually done it in a major bowl playoff situation. They just took out an SEC powerhouse that could have won the national title. So Georgia's it for me. Louisville's a great call. It's just I feel like if you lose to Louisville, it's so much worse than winning. I mean, then it's so much worse as a loss than winning is as a positive, because you got to be able to beat Louisville as a 7-point favorite at home.
I think a good choice on your part too. And I agree with Any Davis too here on Louisville, but I think they're both tipping points in different ways. Beating Louisville, which was a really, really tough game and a great win for Notre Dame, a hard-fought win, that saved the season.
Right. That's true. The season's over if you lose.
Right. Now, Georgia, that's a tipping point of here's Notre Dame in the national landscape. Yeah. Now here's Notre Dame in the national landscape.
And I still the gutsy win over Penn State. That was tremendous, because Notre Dame could have lost that game to Penn State.
I was pretty convinced of it at halftime.
Yeah.
Although the Angeli drive there at the end of the half, but you know, I mean, they had to come out and do things differently in the second half, and they did.
And credit to Dembrock and Freeman, because there was a lot of talk, and I actually partook in it for the first time ever, that Angeli should probably go in when he drove them down, and Riley Leonard was compromised in some way.
Right.
Riley Leonard had a touchdown fallback, to be fair, to his stats in the second.
Yeah, and I'm sure Riley Leonard was doing everything he possibly could in a short amount of time to clear his head and prove to them, I'm ready to go.
But that was not as much of a tipping point as a tremendous win for the program.
Yep.
Next question from World Be Free, which is one of the best names to ever appear on this podcast. If you guys don't know him, his real name is Lloyd. The majority of QBs who have won titles in the last 20 years have been seniors with multiple years of experience. So, any concerns with CJ Carr only having 12 games under his belt? an interesting topic.
It is, and a fair question. My answer is no. but like, you know, and if it was somebody other than CJ Carr, you know, if it was one of many former Notre Dame quarterbacks, I would, you know, probably agree. But I, like, who among us in the media that's privy to practice, privy to interviews, you know, players, coaches, teammates, what have you, we've come to understand and see from CJ Carr is that this guy is driven in ways that most other football players aren't. And they're all driven to a large extent, but this guy is off the chart. And so, again, I think it's a fair question. I think the playoff experience would have been great for him and the rest of the team. That's something we haven't talked about going into this season, that they don't have that, and we're expecting 12-0 and a run to the national title game. It sure would have been nice to have that playoff experience, win or lose or whatever happened, you know, last year. But they don't. And with TJ Carr, I don't think that's too worrisome.
In fairness, I mean, Mac Jones was a senior, but Mac Jones was behind Tua Tagovailoa the whole time. It wasn't like he was a three-year grizzled veteran. I think J.J. McCarthy is a great example of the veteran quarterback that grew into it. Fernando Mendoza and Will Howard were transfers with new teams. I guess they're experienced guys too. But, you know, you never went into the year thinking, well, Fernando Mendoza, that guarantees Indiana national team. I mean, you know, Will Howard was not the best player on his offense. No, but
you mentioned J.J. McCarthy, the trajectory of J.J. McCarthy, he needed that last year to be the guy that led them to a national title. I don't see C.J. Carr in the same light.
Right. That's totally agree. Stetson Bennett was a veteran, but was he a part-time starter with J.T. Daniels prior to that? He wasn't really the guy that drove that entire bus either. Stetson Bennett on Georgia. There was a few guys on defense that were pretty good to help him out. Yeah, it's not a concern for me. It would be a real concern if maybe CJ Carr was last year's CJ Carr.
Which, again, none of us have that in mind. We don't expect that.
No, I'm saying if he was actually a redshirt freshman right now, I would think.
Oh, yeah. I see.
Yeah, that's a pretty good concern because that was one of the concerns last year.
Yeah, it's concern enough that he hasn't been in a playoff game, let alone.
Right.
You know, this would be. They're going to go 12-0, and CJ Carr's never played. That would be a little bit more. Yeah.
Our next question from Jay Holtje. Or Holtje. Assuming our base package is the 11 personnel, which, by the way, is three receivers, a running back, and tight end, which do we see more of this season? 10 personnel to get four receivers on the field, or 12, which Notre Dame often does, I'm editorializing here, that's two tight ends to get Ian Creamer on the field. Priester, I will give you all the tight ends, not just the freshmen we've never seen play.
Yeah, you picked a bunch of good questions here, Tim. I think it's fair. I don't, and we all know that Mike Denbrock, you know, when he had Daniels at LSU, man, he opened it up and let it go. But I still think Denbrock's a guy that, and, you know, short yardage situations, I still think Denbrock's a guy that likes using 12 personnel, maybe not as much as some offensive coordinators that really want to wing it. But I don't know, maybe as an observer of it, for me, my comfort zone is 12 personnel.
Yeah, I don't see them taking the tight end off the field too often for the boundary receiver to be named later. Or the young unproven receiver to be named later. I think Flanagan helps in many ways because when he's not on the field, you can't check to the run. Cooper.
Okay.
If you're taking Cooper Flanagan off the field and it's a base down and CJ Carr sees something and he wants to check to running play, you wish you had Cooper Flanagan.
Yeah,
you can't a lot more than you want to have your boundary receiver to be named later on the field.
Yeah, so, you can't take Cooper Flanagan. Cooper Flanagan won't come off the field a whole lot.
There'll be a lot of 11 personnel. Three receivers, a tight end, and a running back. There will be a lot of 11 personnel. And if Ian Preamer is good enough to make them want to go to 12, I like Ian Preamer and 12 personnel more than I like the boundary receiver to be named later.
In order of how they will be used, 11, 12, and 10.
Yeah, that's.
And I don't even know about 10. That's just kind of. Speculate. Yeah. Question from CMU Pens fan. Over the past 25 years, in which seasons were you the most optimistic about the team and conversely pessimistic going into it? The seasons do not have to play out the way you thought either.
That's a good question because, you know, sometimes you use confirmation bias and go back. I know the year that I was wrong about as a bounce back, not a bounce back, kind of continuation. I thought they would be a solid 9-3 team in Willingham's second year because of the defense, and they were just tragically bad. I was pretty certain that that 06 team had gotten soft, and not that they were bad, but they were nowhere near as good as the national championship level people. They were the number two rated team in the country. I mean, they were not a number two team in the country, Tim, with that offense and that defense in the back seven. As fun as they were to watch the year before, it was just different. In terms of recent years, I was very optimistic about 24 and 25. I was optimistic about 23 and wrong about that. They were softer and the QB was a little softer. Hate to use that term for a quarterback because, but you know, it meant mentally, I mean, I liked all three of those last few years. 2022, I wasn't, you know, that's, it's almost like, let's just see what he can do in his first year. The first thing we said about 2022 was he's going to be a great coach in 5 years. Don't worry about what he does as rookie.
Yeah, that's my thought process. It was 2022. I was just completely open-minded about it. Find your comfort zone. Get settled in. And I wrote about this recently, well, because of the interview that we had with him and just the respect that he commands now. I mean, I bet, like, if you go back and look at the sideline, you know, shots of Freeman on the sideline at the start of the 2022 season, it's just, you know, he's just, there's no comfort zone there. The demeanor is different. So I didn't have any great expectations about 2022 per se. I would say that, and we've talked about this, 2020 was the year where we felt like, because of the pandemic and the way it all came down, yeah, we weren't surprised that Notre Dame was ready to play great football that year. I don't think, and I'm glad you mentioned Willingham in the second year, because when he wins, 10 games the first year and the defense is just so stifling, you figure the offense is going to get better. Love Kent Bear as a defensive coordinator, and
they're not awful. Going,
yeah, I mean they were really bad, and you figure, you know, at least another 9 wins.
Yeah.
The next year, I did want to go back real quickly to 1993, because, you know, from 88
going into
93. Yes. Yeah. Cause from 88 to 92, obviously that was the peak of, and 93, that was the peak of the Lou Holtz era, but excuse me, after, and they peaked at the end of the 92 season.
They were the second best team in the country.
They were really, really good at that point. And then they lost Meyer, Bettis, Tommy Carter, Irv Smith,
Reggie Brooks,
Demetrius Dubose, Devon McDonald was a 4th round draft pick. And then Paulus gets hurt in the preseason. Yeah. Well, you know, that's ingrained in my head walking into the little room in Sports Info and sitting down with Holtz. And Holtz looked like, you know, somebody just run over his dog.
Yeah. There's pessimism. There's pessimism for one of the
better absolutely. But then, you know, then you realize that you do have Bryant Young and you do have Aaron Taylor and you do have Jeff Burris, these first round draft picks, and they were still, you know, good. And then, you know, of course, your substitute quarterback, Kevin McDougal, played like a starting quarterback. God bless him. He had confidence he could do it. Not too many other people did think that he would be able to do it, including his head coach, which is why he was pushing Ron Paulus. But yeah, it's hard to anticipate 4-8. When you haven't been doing 4-8.
It really is. That we did not anticipate 4-8. I remember, and I think Kelly gave a pretty honest answer. I asked him after the season, when did you see this could go wrong? And he said as frankly as he could, because you don't want to look back too much. This is going into 17. I thought we needed to get off to a good start. That's about as frank as a coach can be. And he's like, well, we didn't get off to a good start. I could see some strings pulling, and that's, you know, and obviously it was on him as well, but yeah. that's a fair answer to that 2016 we're talking about. I thought they'd be really good in 2011. I think that's the last time I've listened to players tell me how good they are.
That's fair.
That was preseason. They could not have talked about themselves in a better light to what actually played out on the field to start that season. My God. Related note, kind of, Rakes of Shallow. Great name. I have a feeling you all are going to pick ND to go 12-0. Has anyone at Irish Illustrated or Pete picked ND to go undefeated in a regular season before? The answer quickly, guys, is yes. One of you once said when you're doing your preseason predictions, you like to add a loss to your expectations. Why would that not be the case this year? Is it more about the schedule or more about ND? And I'm going to ask that last sentence later.
That's so kind of 2020, we did make that prediction.
I predict him to go undefeated in 2024, actually, because I said if they beat A&M, and I picked him to beat A&M, they'd go undefeated. And then I was wrong 7 days later. Mm. So that was bad. Bryce picked him to go undefeated last year. I would guess Pete has picked him to go undefeated before. I would wonder if he did in 24. He didn't in 25. He got it. They're going to lose one of those games. Correct.
Yeah.
They lost twice, but you know, he predicted, I don't know which one they're going to lose one of those first two games. I think it was A&M actually.
I can remember saying like leading up to Miami, well, why should Miami be any different this year than they were in these recent years?
Yeah, they were. They changed their
culture. But they were.
Yeah, they really were. They were offensive and defensive line driven, and they beat Notre Dame.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, there was still – well, and that's the thing. I mean, Miami was still questioning their interior defensive line going into the season. There was concern there that these guys aren't – well, they played good football, and now those two starters or two of those guys are back.
That was a rough game to watch if you're a Notre Dame prognosticator because the offensive line just lost. They lost. They got cramped. All right. Well, don't cramp. I mean, Notre Dame's offensive line lost. And there's a 17-year-old kid that was tremendous on Miami. And you're like, are you kidding me right now? This guy's that good. Malachi Toney's that. You kept hearing about how good he was. And then you're still like, holy God, they can't cover.
Yeah, you can't fully envision it. I guess I'm not sure that I went to look at high school film of him. But you know, and I understand, like, you know, why was Carson Hobbs on the field? Well, probably because in preseason practice, he showed that he was the best choice to be on the field. You don't just haphazardly make these decisions. It's decided on the practice field. But, you know, everything Chris Ash touched the first couple of weeks of the season didn't work out well.
Other part of this is good. Would you normally add a loss? And I think we've talked about this before. We add a loss because you're too close to the situation. So like when you're predicting it, you're like, all right, I feel like they're at 11. I feel like they're a 10-2 team. So they're probably going to go 9-3. I don't feel that way with an undefeated team because that means we think they're excellent. And the schedule's part of it.
Well, first of all, let's set the record straight. The only predictions that really, to me, that really matter that you can be more accurate with is week to week. To sit here and predict what's going to happen on November 7th against Miami, I mean, it could be 70 degrees and somebody's injured. Some key player, you know, like sitting here in July and making predictions is just, you know, I don't know what to add to that other than it's very difficult to do because we don't know what condition, what's the state of the team when these games are played week to week. Those are the ones that count the most. I want to be held accountable for the predictions I make on Friday, and I've blown a lot of those to be sure. But you know, July predictions are
I don't mind the dice. July season predictions, but don't tell me to give you the scores of the games all the way through like we do for the fun exercise. You know, that they call the season we do up there. I mean, that's more of like creative writing than it is giving you what you actually. I think you can say I think Notre Dame's a 12-0 team. I think Notre Dame's a 9-3 team. That's not.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think Notre Dame's defense is going to be really stingy against what looks like a lot of bad offenses.
Final question. I wish we had a large panel for this one, Priester. He said, this is related still, Rakes of Shallow had a seat. If Notre Dame
Grabowski.
No, this is Rakes of Shallow still has a seat.
Oh, sorry.
If Notre Dame made the playoff last year, would you feel the same way you do this year going into the year? That's an interesting topic to broach. It's not revenge tour. It's not leave no doubt. It's Notre Dame in the playoffs. They lost to somebody in the quarters or the semis, and what happens?
I'd be even more confident because they have playoff experience.
I love that question though. Like because there's no leave no doubt.
Well, that's you did a good job picking questions this week, Tim, and our readers did a good job of submitting them.
Final question, Grabowski, also wonderful name. If people are not Dicka fans, then you don't get the Grabowski part. But the season is over, and Notre Dame has played 15 games. I like how he left one game out, possibly, but maybe he's saying they got a bye, but I digress, Tim Priester. Which spring standout made the biggest impact on this group in the fall? And you're not all allowed to say Matty Augustine, which is kind of funny. Devin Fitzgerald, Keon Keeley, Bubba Frazier, Jonas Walton, Jaden Sanders and Augustine, and those were all spring standouts. That's a good, not Keeley though. He was a storyline. Keon Keeley. I don't think he was a spring standout. He was definitely a spring storyline.
Yeah, I'm gonna set Augustine aside.
Yeah, because he's a good call here.
my number one pick is Devin Fitzgerald. My number two pick clearly is Jaden Sanders. After that, like Jonas Walton had, and they were standouts. Jonas Walton, Bubba Frazier did a really nice job in the spring, but I just don't know how that's going to translate during the 2026 fall football season. I would love number three to be Keon Keeley, but I'm not.
I think it's fair convinced. To say he could be three, number three with Charlie Partridge and.
Well, that's true. That's true. Well, yeah, actually, you're right. I will put him number three just because those are two freshmen at a position where they're clearly guys, you know, ahead of them in the pecking order.
And we would all go Matty Augustine first here because he might start at right guard. And if he doesn't start at right guard, he might start at right guard as the year progresses. I agree with your order. And I guess Walton would be four because, he's got more chances. We all love Bubba Frazier did a good job, but Bubba Frazier's playing in his position where they have really good players at slot. It's like, imagine if like Graham and Greathouse get hurt at slot, they could just put Faison back at slot instead of going to rookie Bubba Frazier. There's so many slot players available.
I just, you know, Fitzgerald, I mean, I really hope I'm right. I really hope we're right about Fitzgerald because there's a needed boundary. And I'm not saying Micah Gilbert can't do it or Quincy Porter won't be ready at some point or whatever. But, and I realize that Fitzgerald's going against, we saw it against number two guys. I may have said this the other day in a podcast. I would imagine on day one, they're going to see what Devin Fitzgerald can do against the top defense. And let's go from there. You like in your mind, Tim, you can picture the plays that Devin Fitzgerald made. Can you picture any plays that Micah Gilbert made?
No, but I'm thinking of what Devin Fitzgerald's going to look like on day one, when they put him at the number one boundary and he looks across the field at somebody standing there and looks like Devin Fitzgerald's wearing a number 15 jersey when he's trying to get open.
Maybe so, but he can't do any worse than Gilbert did against Moore in the jersey scrimmage.
Yeah, I think he will get an early opportunity to show to him. And hey, it is possible. We have not heard this. It is possible that one of them had a much better summer, Micah Gilbert or Devin Fitzgerald. We have not heard
that. Yeah, I'm hoping. I mean, I Gilbert was my guy going into the spring that I said would emerge. We didn't see it. I'm not saying he can't.
Yeah. He was our guy going into last August too, Micah.
Yeah,
Gilbert.
All we have to go on is the most recent is what we saw in the spring. And Devin Fitzgerald was running through secondaries. It may have been the second team, but he'll get his shots against Notre Dame's number one secondary.
Devin Fitzgerald's going to be really good for Notre Dame someday. We'll see if it's this year or not. Let's give Micah Gilbert credit for one thing. He did score a touchdown and catch a third down pass against Miami. If everybody else had done that, there would have been a different season among Notre Dame's wide receiver core. That was fun. We'll be back. We have more podcasts this week. I believe there might be a Tracking the Trail podcast at the end of the week, in addition to Irish Illustrated Insider. Until then, for Tim Priester of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thank you for watching and listening. Irish Illustrated Insider.